Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we are continuing our Chai Can't Even series, which is a series that we interview young adults in the church. And so today I have on my friend, Parker Johnson, and Parker has a unique story that I have been wanting to share with the Project Zion listeners for a while now. So I'm really glad that we are finally able to sit down and record. So Parker, welcome, and why don't you just introduce yourself briefly to our guests?
Cool. Hi, everybody, and thanks, Brittany. My name is Parker Johnson, and I live and work in Calgary, Alberta, but I am originally from Oklahoma and grew up RLDS Community of Christ.
Awesome. Thank you. So let's start, I guess, just at the very beginning, whatever you define as the very beginning. What was your experience like growing up in Community of Christ? Did you attend camps? What was your involvement like with your family? Just any details that you want to share about growing up Community of Christ?
Sure. So, like I said, I grew up in Oklahoma, and my family, I mean, I would say that I was very much not only going to activities, but also very culturally RLDS Community of Christ. And so that meant that we were at the church multiple times a week, attending various activities. We had a pretty active youth group. We put on plays and skits and had lots of fun there at church, and lots of involvement in the weekly Sunday traditional services. I did attend summer camps from the moment I can remember and before. So my mom has been a teacher most of my life. And so summers were always off for her. And we were able to, my brother and I, able to always attend camps with her, and just really forge some strong bonds there with lots of people from across the Mission Center, or Stake previously, but now Mission Center. Youth camps, I went to quite a few. At a certain point, I kind of stopped going. And most of that was just personal choice and other things going on, other time commitments that I had made before. And so, it just wound up being mostly family camp. What we call reunion in Oklahoma was kind of the biggest summer camp thing that I went to. So trying to think of any other nuggets here that I might be forgetting, but yeah, very culturally RLDS Community of Christ. The congregation that I grew up in had usually about 30, maybe on a good Sunday, 35 people. And it was made up primarily of two larger family groups, my family being one of the two. Yeah, so my grandpa was the pastor for a while. My mom's been co-pastor. Other members of the other family have been pastor. So very small, tight-knit group. But one point that I should make is back whenever I was a kid, we had a peace mobile that we would take around to different camps and like even festivals in small towns across Oklahoma and even in Missouri and Arkansas. And I remember that being a very formative thing for me because as a kid, one of the activities I know was like, coloring your face. You had a mirror in front of you, and we had skin tone colors, not just traditional Crayola box colors. And being able to realize that I'm not white, I'm a different shade of whatever the color may have been, and that a person's not simply black, they are also their own shade of color. Was really important for me, I think, growing up in a place like rural Oklahoma, where I didn't have a lot of kind of those subtle nuances being given to me in school. It was kind of, pardon the pun, but black and white. And so I really appreciated the church kind of stepping in and being that kind of, I don't know, role model for me to think further on some of these issues that sometimes we just get given to us at face value. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. This idea that church, even though maybe everyone that you went to church with looked the same or maybe believed the same or whatever, even if there wasn't a lot of diversity in your context, that the church was still a vehicle in teaching about diversity. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So in your congregation or in your stake at the time, how were you treated as a kid? I mean, were you mentored by people that were older than you? Did you ever feel like maybe you were being led into, say, leadership positions or anything like that? I mean, what was your interaction as a child with the adults in your community?
You know, back in the 90s, when I was growing up, I'm 30 now, the church was pretty strict on things like, you know, you need to be baptized to be able to take communion. There were some rigid rules that we needed to follow. There were steps that needed to be followed to get to priesthood. I can remember specifically a memory when I was just about to turn 8 and my mom asked me if I was ready to become a member of the church. And I looked at her like she was nuts and was like, I am a member of this church. I grew up here. These are my people. And I had no concept of what that meant, for why I had to go through with this kind of sacrament to be able to keep that like actual membership title, or to gain that membership title rather. As far as priesthood, obviously I did get, baptized, but, as far as priesthood or any sort of like leadership role, I very much feel like I was mentored by many adults and my peers growing up, but there wasn't a heavy focus on priesthood that was kind of, that it was like an expectation for any of us. And none of my peers really received a call while we were in high school or anything like that. So there never was this kind of looming kind of fear of what the unknown might be in priesthood world. It just kind of seemed like a thing that probably might happen later on in life, but never really spoke directly about to me or to, as far as I know, to my peers either. And we had a pretty vibrant group as well, as that was my age.
Hmm. Interesting. So in general terms, do you feel like you were like that you fit in and that you were accepted? And was there any like negative aspect, I guess, of your formidable years in the church?
You know, I don't think anything sticks out to me that was blatant. There were a lot of microaggressions, I think, that people didn't realize they were saying or didn't know that I was struggling with my sexuality as a kid. I have memories of being quite young and realizing that I wasn't, air quotes, straight. But I didn't fault them for that because I hadn't verbally mentioned that this was something I was struggling with. But there was also kind of this just assumed traditionalism that existed in that congregation that, I mean, culturally, I'm in rural Oklahoma. It's part of the Bible Belt. It's very conservative, you know, even now. And so I just kind of knew to keep my mouth shut in all contexts of life, whether it's church or not. But the funny part for me was I felt that church, and I still feel this way, that the church in Oklahoma specifically is more progressive than Oklahoma is. And so I felt that as a kid, even though it hadn't been, we didn't have any sort of pro-LGBTQ policies or anything at that time. We had quite exclusionary policies, actually. But no one had ever, you know, contrary to what my friends and peers in high school who were attending Baptist churches or, you know, other like Catholic or actually we don't have very many Catholics back in Oklahoma, but they had more blatant references to point to that says like, you know, God does not like gay people and gay people are wrong and it's a sin and it's a choice. And I never had any of that given to me. And so I didn't inherit that sense of shame until later after the conversation kind of started from the church side, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So it wasn't explicitly taught to you, but maybe in some microaggressions that would come out just in general terms. But if I'm hearing you correctly, it wasn't like outright attacks against who you were as a person, which on one hand, like I really appreciate, but on the other hand, it also seems like that would be kind of confusing as a kid. I mean, like to understand whether or not you are fully accepted of with who you are. I mean, because if you're not necessarily getting clear answers from your church and it's almost just like, it seems like it's almost painting a don't ask, don't tell situation where you don't feel like you can be genuine about who you are.
Yeah. And it very much was one of those don't ask, don't tell situations. That's a good way of putting it. But I don't think anybody really knew that I was struggling with that at the time. And so I felt like I was being genuine because I didn't know what I was yet. And I was just kind of trying to work through that. But the writing was on the wall for me. I knew, you asked about priesthood and mentorship earlier. I knew that if I made that, if I verbally said I'm gay, then all of these things would no longer be available to me, including priesthood. And so, you know, that was something that was always looming in the back of my head, but it wasn't explicitly said to me. It was just, I knew that our church hadn't ever addressed that topic. The good thing though, I mean, I do appreciate growing up that, you know, I never really heard hellfire damnation type sermons from the pulpit growing up. And nor did anyone really ever explicitly make reference to marriage being between a man and a woman. Like it just, no one ever thought to have to say that because it was just assumed that everybody was on the same page, which looking back, you know, that's problematic in and of its own, in and of itself, but it also freed me from hearing that and internalizing that as a child in the church. And I was able to just fit myself in where I felt I could along my own journey. So hopefully that makes sense. And I certainly don't fault the people of my congregation for not addressing the issue because it just hadn't been addressed anywhere quite yet, at least in any sort of formal capacity. But I hold on to the fact that it's a very unique situation that a person's culture is more conservative than their church. I think that's kind of a unique piece of my story that I really cling to a lot of times because I really appreciate that the church was that kind of differentiator for my family. Because culturally, we should have been completely against all of these things, but religiously, we weren't, we at least not explicitly. And so we've been shown other things. And backing up a little bit, I also mentioned, you know, growing up, as a young person, I remember being a part of this international faith community and how formative that was for me because I remember we had some Ukrainian church members come through our stake at the time and they visited our congregation. And I had never met anybody outside of the tri-state area, really. And I'd never seen anybody speak a language like Ukrainian or like write differently than me, or, I mean, I'd been around Spanish culture, Mexican culture, but I'd not really seen anything like that at all. And so it was really eye-opening for me to be a part of an international community, and it kind of opened me up again to those subtle nuances of what it means to be diverse and to have to be flexible and to not be so hard-lined about things. And so, yeah, that even though I was in a small, tiny rural town in Oklahoma and went to a rural congregation in Oklahoma, I still had access to all these amazing cultural experiences that I would never have been opened up to had I not been a part of the community of Christ.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's interesting hearing you talk. In my mind, I was just kind of reeling over how much social progression has happened in the last, you know, 20 years. And this idea that you growing up in rural Oklahoma and your congregation, even though they weren't explicitly inclusive or welcoming or affirming of the LGBTQ community, they also weren't fire and brimstone and you're going to hell like others were as well. And so it's just interesting to think of social context and how far we have come. But then, you know, how far that your community had already come as far as accepting and just kind of having this cultural understanding that this was the norm, but not necessarily explicitly attacking something that was outside of that norm. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's just, it's interesting because, you know, growing up, me as a Mormon in Utah, those messages were sent out on almost a weekly basis at church. And so I myself am not LGBTQ, but I have a lot of friends that are, and we've interviewed a lot of people on this podcast who grew up Mormon and queer. And just that difference, I'm just playing out that difference in my mind, and it gives me hope. It gives me a lot of hope.
Definitely. I think you probably put it better than me, quite honestly.
No.
I struggle with verbalizing some of these feelings because it's still kind of unfolding for me. And so when I look back, I'm trying to think of why I feel the way I feel about certain things or when the first time I may have felt shame would have been. And in most cases, it was outside of my church life. It was my cultural kind of societal friends and family and things like that, that where it might've been said, or little microaggressions here and there that might've happened, that kind of made me realize, oh, okay, this is where we land on this issue. But in church, it was either avoided, or just unintentionally seen as a non-issue, like, and therefore not talking about it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, not to harp on this too much, but when I am interacting with Latter-day Seekers, or people who are just in general interested in community of Christ and maybe how, things like national conferences have come about, et cetera. One thing that I always try to stress is this, the theology is different. And so, to not have a complete genderized concept of heaven or concept of God, I mean, that really impacts the on the grounds congregational life when you don't say like God is explicitly male married to a heterosexual woman. I mean, those things matter. So when we talk about like the nature of God and things like that, to me, it has very, very real life application of either doing a lot of harm or validating harmful thoughts or ideas, et cetera. So I really appreciate you telling your story because it kind of confirms my thoughts that when you take that deeply genderized, sexualized theology out of who God is and what the purpose of life is, that it just kind of relaxes everything. And even though it's not perfect, you know, like the church that you grew up in was not perfect in handling LGBTQ issues. But at least it wasn't fire and brimstone. And like you said, any shame that you did develop ended up coming from sources outside of the church, which, yeah, I'm really glad that you articulated that.
Yeah. And I will say I struggled with worthiness issues because of church's policies on queer inclusion, but, we can talk about that later. And I also think it's important to say that, you know, as a millennial, I grew up in Community of Christ post women in the priesthood, that decision being made. And so my whole life was spent with equality across the spectrum in my religious setting. And so I never had to really look at those kind of the church, I still think, is patriarchal in a lot of ways, has a lot of those things that still kind of stick around. But whereas like where I grew up, women couldn't be in ministerial roles and a lot of denominations that I was surrounded by. And yet my mom was in the priesthood and my mom spoke on Sundays, and like it just kind of opened me up, I guess, again, to like other ways of seeing things in a much more equitable way that allowed me to see the gifts and uniqueness that people can bring to the table, rather than trying to fit a very square peg into a very round hole. And I think I stored that somewhere in the back of my mind for now, when I'm trying to just be myself and fit into church context. And I don't want the square peg round hole. I want to be able to just be seen as valued and me. So,
yeah, I really, really like that and appreciate that. So let's continue moving forward on the timeline, if you will. And let's talk about your church involvement in like your, I guess, are we still considered young adults in the church? I guess maybe we are, but like your young adults, like, you know, 18, you've graduated, college, you know, what was your involvement like when you essentially moved out for the first time?
Sure. So with college years, after I graduated from high school in Oklahoma, I actually went to SPEC that summer and was recruited to go to Graceland University, which is the church-sponsored university in Southern Iowa. And I had already enrolled at the University of Oklahoma, but wound up withdrawing and decided to just go ahead with my experience being at Grayson University. So best decision I ever made, because for me, I grew up in a small town. Going to university in a small town was also a really helpful kind of thing for me, because I was able to be in a safe space that I recognized and knew how to function within. And then also having a, you know, high quality experience from an academic perspective. The other part of that is that there was a strong sense of community at Graceland. And whether or not I went to church, which I generally didn't in university, it felt like I was at church all the time because I was surrounded by people who carry with them the same kind of cultural foundation that I did. And a lot of people that I went to university with at Graceland were the children of apostles or some sort of ministerial position in the church. And so in a lot of ways, we really had very similar backgrounds. And it just felt like we were living out Zionic community, if that's a fair way to say that. But I really did. And so my own friend group were church members from Ontario, Canada, and across the United States. And it was just nice that we would just break out into campfire songs sometimes and like people just got you, you know, like that sounds really geeky because it is, but I still do that. And they understood the context that you were coming from. And having grown up in a place that the church doesn't have such a strong presence in, it was really refreshing for me to realize that A, I'm not entirely crazy. And B, that like there are more people like me. And there are people like me who carry that foundational religious cultural context and accept me because I later came out at Graceland. And so that was really formative for me to know that, hey, I actually have a place here. These are the children of our own apostles and church officials, and they're telling me that I'm okay. And as strange as that sounds, that was really important for me, I think, for me to feel like I actually still had a place and it was worth continuing to pursue. Because for a while I was struggling with whether or not to come out, I just thought, well, if I say the words, then I'm giving up my church community because the church hadn't actually addressed that issue yet. So I didn't really go to church while I was at Graceland. Sometimes I would go to the chapel services. But generally speaking, like I said, I think being around the community there was a form of church in and of itself. No matter what we were doing, it just felt like I was loved and appreciated and supported. And we were able to, I think cover a lot of really important topics in a safe friend group. So,
yeah, it's really interesting hearing you talk about debating whether to come out or not. And from what I'm hearing you say is there was almost a sense of unknown that because the church hadn't addressed it and given kind of a hard line either way, there was probably a sense of deep uncertainty of how your community, whether that's the Graceland community or your Oklahoma community, et cetera, were going to respond, which it seems more nerve-wracking than if you know what the consequences are going to be and you go forward with it. But to be able to do it not knowing what's going to happen and not knowing what relationships you're going to lose, which I think everyone deals with that to some degree. But when the church is so much part of who you are and your college community, et cetera, that just kind of adds a whole new a layer of courage from my perspective.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was that unknown because the church hadn't addressed it. And just not knowing where I fit in, you know, I knew that if I didn't say it, I could continue holding on to this community. But by saying it, I feared that I might lose it. It's worth mentioning, I actually came out in the churchiest way possible. I was serving a World Service Corps volunteer position in Western Canada. For those who don't know, World Service Corps is a cultural exchange program that Community of Christ offers. And so you apply, and then if there's a site that has the request for a volunteer to come to their location, you are assigned based on your skills and background and level of comfort for various scenarios that you might encounter to a specific area. So I was assigned to Western Canada. I'd never left the United States. I'd never had a passport. So I think that was the best place for me to go. And lo and behold, it's where I work now. So it worked out well, I think. But I wound up actually coming out to my parents over the phone while I was serving my World Service Corps. I don't want to call it a mission, but my World Service Corps position. So I was surrounded by church people. I was terrified that I would be losing. I was terrified that if actually people found out that I might get sent home, even though there really wasn't a policy to say yay or nay otherwise. But I remember distinctly that I had this really, you know, emotional conversation in a church member's basement because I was staying in a church member's home in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I'd had this really long conversation with my parents and I was emotional. And at the end of the conversation, I went upstairs and I'm not sure if she heard the whole thing or not, but whatever it was, she was, I really feel strongly that she was led to be very motherly to me in that moment. And she was, and I needed that really badly in that moment because my parents and I, it was a really tough topic and I'd never said it to them before. And, you know, they were just struggling. And so there was a lot of unknowns again about where things might lead. But as I came up the steps from the basement afterwards, my eyes are all puffy. There was a cup of tea waiting for me at the table. And we didn't really talk about it, the conversation I just had, but she was just kind of that Christ at the table for me that I needed at that moment. And so in my coming out story, the church is integrally involved, whether it wanted to be or not. And I really appreciate that about my story, just that, you know, this community that I find to be so important at a foundational level for me actually was there for me immediately after the coming out happened. And I maintain a very strong relationship with this woman today. And I was able to actually introduce my mom to her at World Conference last time. So 2016. Yeah. And that was really important for me to be able to like connect those people. My parents are the most loving and affirming people, but everyone would struggle with some news like that in the beginning. And so, you know, of course it just was really important for me. So the church has been around my queerness since before they even knew, but they also were involved in my coming out. And I really love that. So.
Yeah. Oh, Parker, I just have to say, I love the grace that you're throwing at everybody, you know, the church and the fact that, you know, when you were growing up, they weren't necessarily overly affirming and it was kind of this inward struggle to you, but you did affirm that they were kind of working with where they were at and, you know, that you're just able to find positives in it. And again, with your parents, just what you just said about how anyone would struggle with news like that at the beginning. I think sometimes I guess I should speak for myself. I just kind of assume that people should already be where I'm at on a topic, whether that's, you know, something that's personal to me or whatever it may be. Sometimes I have a hard time maybe giving people the same grace that I see you give. So thank you for that. It's inspiring.
Well, it's easier for me to do than I think people actually might assume because I'm just as homophobic as the people I grew up with because I grew up in a homophobic society. And so people, I think, forget that, you know, just because I am gay, they think that I grew out of, I don't know, it's almost like I was hatched from a different society. But I'm like, nope, I was socialized just the same as you. And I received all the same messages just the same as you. But instead of, you know, depending on the other person's sexuality or gender identity, I internalized it because it was directly speaking to my circumstances. And so, there's a lot to unpack there, but it's easier for me to do it than I think a lot of people think. And it's not so much me being super great person about it all. It's more that like, hey, I get it. Like, I actually struggle with some of those things too. And I'm the one that's actually gay, you know? And that's, I'm laughing now. It's actually really terribly sad at the same time, but we all are very influenced by socialization. And I don't think that we always realize that, you know, where we come from is deeply embedded in who we are for the rest of our lives. And that, you know, good luck unpacking it for the rest of your life. And that's not a terrible thing. It's just that it's just, you have to understand that it's part of who you are. So while I definitely understand what you mean, Brittany, it's not exactly me just being a super kind person. It's just me being able to relate to my own people, if that makes sense.
So. Yeah, well, and, you know, being able to sit in the reality of our own biases and our own struggles and our own, like you said, just socialization and upbringing. Yeah, but I mean, to recognize that, I think is a really good first step and something that sometimes we are quick to overlook. So,
no, thanks.
So I guess let's just talk about, because if I remember right, Parker and I, we're good friends, so we've chatted about all of the things before. But I do know that you took an intentional step away from the church for a period of time. But also I'm realizing that I don't know a lot of details about that. So if you would you like to share about that and maybe what ended up causing you to step away? Was it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, and then maybe talk about, you know, why you decided to become involved again with the church?
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. I mean, I think most people going to university, and maybe, well, I'll speak for myself. I won't make a sweeping generalization. I just needed to take a step back and to find out who I was in university. So that was kind of the initial purpose of it. But I found that growing, learning and growing, and then becoming more in touch with who I was and with my sexuality and being more and more okay with, you know, preparing myself to say the words that I'm gay. So I think that, you know, my initial stepping away from the church was predominantly because I just needed to find out who I was. And I think that's a kind of typical university age thing to say. But I found that the further down the road I went of kind of becoming more accepting of myself and more okay with being able to come out, the further I had to separate myself from the church, because, you know, the process of coming out is an ongoing thing. But especially when you're trying to say it for the first time, you really recognize all those things that you're hung up on. Those last few things that you just can't let go of, or you feel like you can't let go of and be gay. And the church was one of those things. And so I really kind of actually felt forced to let it go. I didn't want to let it go. It was actually devastating for me to let it go. But when you come out, you are recognizing the risk in what you're saying. So I'm gay. Saying that out loud actually means that I might lose all these other things, including my family and my church family. But it's important to me to be able to be authentically me. And therefore, I have to be okay with losing those incredibly important things to me. And that's really difficult. And that's why coming out is so horrible, is because you have to be kind of okay with coming up with a plan B. And nobody wants to do that. So that actually propelled me into taking an even bigger step away from the church, because I needed the church to prove to me that I was wanted and that I was worthy. And really, I didn't get back involved in church too much until the national conference in the U.S. came out, the decision from that conference, rather. And I remember I was at a coffee shop in Oklahoma City, and I found out the results of that, and I was like, what? We did what? I had no idea that we were, because I hadn't been paying attention to where we were. And so the journey of the church, really, I had completely stepped out of. And the moment that that happened, it was like this warm, warm feeling just kind of came over me that I can come back now. And it was almost just as simple as that for me to know that, you know, without me poking and prodding, the church still went there. And without me crying and whining that I wasn't being included, the church still included me. And that really was important to me. So it really was the national conference decision that led me back into feeling like it was going to be healthy for me to be involved in the church, because the church had actually made a stand on this issue. So at that point, that's whenever I kind of re-entered the scene. I haven't really looked back ever since. There've been some bumps along the way, of course, involving priesthood, which we can talk about later if you'd like, but generally, I think I was craving my church family so much, but just wouldn't allow myself to go there until they had done the work to be affirming. So,
yeah, thank you for that. I think that it's just so interesting, because I've talked to people who, you know, were part of that process to have the church in the U.S. become inclusive, and then have heard stories of people in other countries that have helped their countries have national conferences and come to similar conclusions. But the idea that, you know, these decisions really actually impacted lives, that it's not just kind of this fun little platitude that we can sing and dance with, but that it actually has impacted people's lives to the point of coming back to the church, or feeling like they can finally be in congregational life and not have to be so ashamed. Not saying that it's perfect, and I definitely want to hear your thoughts post-national conference, but that, you know, this actually, it matters. And that almost sounds trite and silly to say that it matters, but I think that sometimes, you know, we forget that it actually does. And so, I don't know, just picturing you in a coffee shop in Oklahoma and hearing the news, it just really kind of brings it all full circle, that you know, we can talk about these issues. We can kind of use it as, you know, quote unquote selling point for the church. But that it really did impact people who had dedicated their lives to the church prior to National Conference. So thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I guess let's just continue. I would really like to hear your thoughts post-National Conference and just kind of your involvement with the church and what has happened. You said that there were some bumps along the way. So I guess just start talking about those if you want.
Sure. I should mention, I've been following an organization called Church Clarity, and I really appreciate their mission. And they have a kind of a hashtag that they use on a lot of things that they post, and it's clarity is reasonable. And I really, really stand behind that. I think that that is so important because, and they're talking specifically about church policies relating to the queer community. And so it's reasonable to expect a church to have on its website, for example, where it is in that journey, because I don't think it's healthy to kind of lead me on to believe that you're okay with it, and then I'm only potentially going to encounter a really negative experience. And so clarity is reasonable is something that I really believe strongly in. And, you know, this National Conference predates Church Clarity's hashtag, but that's where my head was at, was I needed clarity surrounding this issue because I was, you know, kind of in a self-preservation mode, I guess you could say, about the issue. And so that kind of led me to coming back as having that clarity surrounding that. So since National Conference, you know, I feel a little conflicted about the National Conference model, if I'm being completely honest. I think that when you're dealing with an international organization, it is difficult to have a sweeping policy that would just impact all nations that we exist in. And recognizing that different parts of the world are, you know, dangerous for queer people obviously presents issues. But I still struggle. And I struggle because I feel like there's some theological issues that come up when we talk about nation or country-specific priesthood calls. So if I'm called in one country, to me, I don't even think about national boundaries as being a limitation to my priesthood. But as far as where it's recognized, it suddenly becomes a problem because, you know, what if I'm asked to go to Haiti, which I wouldn't, because obviously that's a place where it's dangerous for me to go. But it means that I'm no longer whatever priesthood office that I hold, at least in practice on the ground. And that's a really interesting concept for me to realize, like, oh, there are limits. And, you know, for good reason, there are safety issues, like I said. But it still begs the question for me, who's doing the calling and why are we putting limitations on it? And maybe that's more just an open-ended concern of mine, but it's something that I really struggle with a lot. The other thing is, the national churches don't exist in the org chart for the church. So at the top of the hierarchy, if you will, is the World Church Organization. Beneath that is the Mission Center. So in the United States, I don't even know how many mission centers we have, but there is no such thing as an American church in Community of Christ. However, we formed a national conference specifically for that question. And so did all the other countries that have done one so far. But what happens if I want to submit a resolution to amend our current policy? Who do I send that to? Or, you know, what national conference body, how do we call that again? Who's in charge? And it seems kind of impossible for me to be able to do that because I would have to get buy-in from all the mission centers across the country all over again to say that this issue is important enough to change it. And so, yeah, I struggle for various reasons on that, the national conference model. However, it's where we are. And, you know, but I am proud of the forward motion that we've continued with. And I think that it's progress nonetheless. And so I'm not going to complain that we've become affirming in certain places. I struggle with the method that got us there. For me, I guess I'll talk about my priesthood call experience. So in the United States, for those who are listening from outside of the US, or who maybe just aren't terribly familiar with same-sex marriage equality in the U.S. We received that right from a SCOTUS decision, the Supreme Court decision, in 2015 in June. And I received my call to the Office of Elder in March or April of the following year. And the U.S. church had had its national conference several years prior to that, but it was at that point leading up to the Supreme Court decision, it was simply a state-by-state issue. So if you lived in Massachusetts, for example, you could perform gay weddings, but if you lived in Oklahoma, for example, that was a no. So there are even more strict, more boundary-related issues before the SCOTUS decision. But I was elated whenever I got my priesthood call. And to the point of tears, I was just so grateful for a church that saw my worthiness and could look beyond this one part of me, my sexuality, and call me to an office that I felt extremely appropriate. I was called to elder. But the struggle came when it was approved at all levels until some of the World Church staff realized that I was living with my partner. And my partner and I have been together for almost 7 years now. At the time, we would have been living together for 4 years, I guess, because marriage hadn't been an option. I kind of had the brakes slammed a bit by my Mission Center president at the time, who said, you know, this is an issue. Do you have documentation that you're in a committed relationship? And I said, well, actually, yes, we lived in Denver. We had a certificate of committed partnership. And that allowed us to enjoy certain rights and privileges that some married people enjoy, but that predated civil unions and marriage equality. And so I submitted that only to have World Church staff say, well, this is no longer the highest level of recognition that you can get as a United States citizen anymore. Therefore, you need to pursue that. And for me, that was a really devastating moment because I didn't see the grace in the policy anymore. And it felt more about the majority than it felt about being inclusive of the minority. I think different people react differently. I know even in the queer community, some, the moment that same-sex marriage became legal, ran out and got married right then, and more power to them. I'm happy that they're in a place where they feel that they can go and do that. Me, on the other hand, and I don't know if it's just from growing up in Oklahoma or what, but I struggle with worthiness surrounding that sacrament because for the better part of my life, I was taught that, marriage is between a man and a woman. And whether it was explicitly or implicitly, it was still very much understood that that was the case. And for the church to suddenly turn around and say, not only have we included you, you now have to do this thing that we told you you were not worthy for, most of your life, has been a huge struggle for me. And it's kind of, how do I say this? It's kind of, I don't want to say invalidated because that's not right. It hasn't invalidated the change for me or the journey to be affirming or welcoming, but it's kind of reduced the importance of priesthood for me in my life because I don't know that I need the church to tell me that I'm in that position to be able to provide that ministry. And so, you know, it just is no longer relevant in that regard for me. I don't need the church to tell me that I'm an elder. I can be in that position. I mean, obviously I wouldn't be performing marriages or anything like that. But I can provide ministry without the church's blessing. And that's okay. I'm okay in that headspace. But that is my biggest struggle right now, is having been told by the church that I'm not worthy enough for this sacrament, to then have them turn around and tell me that there's a hard line policy that says I have to move towards this historically very heteronormative tradition, which is the sacrament of marriage, has been incredibly problematic for me in my theology and in my own life. Preston and I are both quite disappointed in that. And so that's something that I'm still working through, and I think that I'll eventually come around to hopefully being okay with the church's decision on that. But at the moment, I continue to press the First Presidency to readdress this issue But like I said, I don't know where to begin since I don't know how to call back a national conference. But I feel a little bit stuck, if that's fair.
I think that's more than fair. And I, you know, I just want to thank you for sharing this part of your story, because I think that, I think a lot of things, but I think that when we as a church or an institution or a community make a decision like this, we don't often think of, I don't want to say collateral damage, because that sounds insensitive, but just the complexities, I guess, of merging cultures together. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about the history of queer culture, but I do know that it is dynamic and that it's changed, and that heterosexuals have literally written this community out of the story. And so to then assume that we, you know, quote unquote, have arrived by making a policy change, which did have a very positive impact, but to assume that that policy change is perfect and that it can move forward without any bumps in the road, I think is not a realistic picture of what's actually happening. And I will say that this ties very closely in general terms in the conversation about cohabitation and priesthood. And I think this conversation has been around for a while. And I think that, you know, we can look at maybe older couples that can't get married because of social security issues and things like that. And then we look at, you know, the LGBTQ community and how, like you said, this sacrament that we, the straight people, have completely put a wall up against the sacrament and this community on both a church level and a political level is a reality that we have to face. And if we expect that once those walls are taken down, that the cultures are just going to naturally mesh, it's a little more complicated than that. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up. I know that it wasn't until I started talking with you, Parker, that I realized, you know, my definite straight privilege in this, and, you know, really, really, really praising this concept of national conference and how I thought it was such a good model. And like you said, it can be for where we are today, especially because there are countries where it is dangerous to be gay. And so how do we juggle that as an international church? But then, you know, to bring it home and talk about for a large period of time, months and months and months, there was just differences according to what state you were in. And so it's like, who's really calling the shots here? You know, it's almost like the church bowing down to the laws of the land, if you will, and dictating how we are able to liberate ministers based on legalities of a government. And that's a conversation worth having, I think. So,
yeah. And I think it depends on how we define danger too, because I do find it, you know, I understand that Haiti is much more dangerous to be a queer person, for example. I'm picking on Haiti, but it's just because it's a well-known place that's not quite friendly to gay people, to put it lightly. But in the United States, in our own country, you can be legally fired for being gay in more than half of the US states, last time I checked. And so for the church to pressure me to go down and get legally married, which is a public record document, is absolutely foolish. The church doesn't know, it seems to me, I guess I should say, the church doesn't understand what my lived experience is like. I know how to function as a gay person in America, especially in the South. The church doesn't. And to create a blanket statement, which while again, I appreciate the forward motion and movement on this topic, it's not a blanket policy. I'm sorry, but it's something that it's just as dangerous in a lot of cases. Economically speaking, violence could happen, physical violence, depending on where you live. Families could break apart. And, you know, it's just a difficult thing. So until our country politically can stand at a much more consistent place on queer issues, it's difficult for the church to try to force that consistency on all 50 states. And I can't speak to the other national conferences and how they're handling them, but specifically to the US, it's certainly been problematic for me.
Yeah, I really like how you said consistency until, again, context is the US, but until we can be consistent about something like this, because again, this is real people's lives at stake, which might sound dramatic to some, but I think those who have lived the gay or the queer experience in the US, it's actually not dramatic at all. So
great.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for sharing that struggle, which, you know, was kind of one of my questions is, what are the complexities of being a young adult or a millennial in the church? And I think that this particular policy or this kind of group of policies, when we talk about cohabitation and marriage and how that influences young people, is a really good example of just some of these difficult dynamics that we have to walk through. And I also will say that I appreciate that you're sticking it out with the church and, you know, that you are employed with the church and continuing to bring ministry without the ministerial validation of a priesthood office. I think that that takes a lot of courage and just real commitment to trying to guide the church along to change.
Mm. Well, thank you. I could do the same thing about you, Brittany, in so many other ways too. So
now I just want to like sing High School Musical. We're all in this together.
That's right.
Oh gosh. I'd like to talk a little bit about the benefits of religious communities in the world today. I feel like our generation, and I've said this several times on Chai Can Even, but our generation tends to be stepping away from organized religion and we lean towards the spiritual but not religious realm of life. So I just want to know your thoughts on that. Do you see a purpose in organized religious communities, and what would those benefits and what would the purpose be, et cetera?
Sure. I've grown to kind of loathe that phrase, spiritual but not religious, just after being gone through the Community of Christ Seminary program with you, Brittany. And the reason is a colleague of mine actually said, and I thought that it was like the craziest answer at the time, but he said, I think I'm more religious than spiritual. And I thought, well, that's just crazy. I don't even know what that means. And then as I unpacked that, I was like, oh my gosh, like I think I'm actually kind of more religious than spiritual because I am so culturally this Community of Christ thing that like it's so much about the community to me. It's so much about these like traditions that we have, such as the camping programs and our, you know, rituals and our kind of continued push for growth and development theologically and spiritually, all that together. But there's a lot to say about that like connection to just the organized religious part. It kind of sounds weird to even say out loud, but and maybe it's maybe not positive or negative, but I don't know. Have you ever thought about that?
Well, yeah. So yeah, I guess that's something that we didn't really mention. Parker and I we just finished seminary together. Well, Parker still has his exit interview. God bless him. But we had a class on contemporary culture and religion and all these topics or the things that we studied. And it really kind of drove home to me what you're saying, Parker, is that any amount of religion or spirituality comes out of a culture. It comes out of a community. And you can't really separate it. Even if you try to do spirituality in isolation, whether that's meditation or you know, any sort of spiritual practice that you can do on your own, that still came out of a culture and out of a community. And for me, like I see religion as such a vehicle to drive society in a direction, whether that's progressive or regressive, if you will, or, you know, it just social change has impacted so much on religion. So I agree with you, Parker. I often find myself really, really grounded in community and in this idea that we are part of something bigger than ourselves and that God weaves in and through that. There's something really beautiful about that. So
yeah,
that's my long answer to say, I totally get what you're saying.
Exactly. And I think that, a lot for young people today and for anybody today, a lot of times it's issues of transparency or, you know, going back to my clarity is reasonable talk earlier, that drive people away from religious communities because it seems to be this kind of hypocrisy, modern day hypocrisy. And there you see a lot of people trying to circumvent the religious institution to get to the outcome from the religious institution. I know I was guilty of that. But if you ignore the former, the latter will eventually fizzle. And this is my opinion. I think that you can always be a spiritual person, but you always have to have something to derive that spirituality from. And your centeredness has to come from somewhere and your support system has to come from somewhere. And I'm not saying that it has to come from any one particular tradition either. You could be drawing that from, you know, Buddhism and Community of Christ or Catholicism or other denominations of Christianity or Hinduism or Baha'i or whatever that floats your boat. But at the same time, you need to have a strong support system as you go through that because religion and spirituality, kind of as you touched on, Brittany, are such communal, I would call them processes. It's something that you have to go on a journey with somebody else. And in, at certain times, of course, you'd want to take time for yourself to kind of reflect or discern for yourself on various topics and issues or scriptures, for example. But there's importance there surrounding that community. So the benefits of religious communities in today's world, I think it can't be understated it can't be overstated that it's just so important for us to be able to connect with people on things outside of the secular world and to be able to do that together and to work together on investing in each other, whether that's through sitting and listening or helping to mentor someone or simply to learn and grow from other experiences that you might not have normally come to know. I think those are really important things. And I always say that, like, if it weren't for the church, I don't know what other part of my life would allow me contact with people from such a broad spectrum of ages. Because generally, I would just run with people my age. Like, that's how friendships tend to work. I have my parents, I have grandparents. But generally speaking, that's how we run around. And we have our support groups that are pretty much an echo chamber. But it becomes difficult, and I'd say more impactful, when you are surrounded by people from multiple generations, from multiple life experiences and backgrounds, to be able to help inform your center and your compass, and to help you to kind of grow into more spirituality. But I really would argue that you need the communal religious aspect of that. And again, I think for me that changed. The seminary program really kind of opened my eyes to that because I didn't see any problem prior to that to just kind of, like I said, circumventing the church to get to the positive outcomes. But I've learned that, again, if you ignore the former, the latter is essentially kind of no use at a certain point.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. One thing that you lifted up that a lot of people maybe in our generation are concerned about transparency and things not being clear. And then you said that quote again about, what was it?
Clarity is reasonable.
Clarity is reasonable, yes. So I'm reading the newest Brené Brown book, and over and over again in the book, she says, clarity is kind. And I think that relates, you know, when we know what is expected of us, when we know where we can make change, when things are clear, it fosters just a more functional community. And that's one thing that I like in Community of Christ is that we can push back. We can find where those pockets of unclarity are and we can have conversations about them. Even if it is confusing about, you know, okay, so if we want to address this thing about national conferences or priesthood and cohabitation or whatever it may be, what are the proper channels to do that? But I do have hope that there are proper channels, and that there are people who are willing to listen and people who are willing to take the life experiences of real people and have that impact decisions that the church makes. And so as far as organized religions go for me, I have said that there actually aren't very many organized religions that I could be a part of, but Community of Christ is, I mean, the community is a capital C, that it's a very, very important aspect of mm-hmm. who we are. And it's grounded in the liberating teachings of Christ. And so to me, that gives me a lot of hope. It gives me hope when I see the evolution that the church has taken over the last 100 years, and just knowing that our voices and our stories really do matter. And all the while we can worship together, we can do spiritual practices together, but this community aspect of it and gathering together, there's something really, really powerful in that.
Totally. And I think, you know, I'm circling back to other things you've asked me before on this recording, but I think that, you know, in our seminary again, Brittany and Tony and Charmaine, if you're, and Matt and everybody who else was on faculty, if you're listening, I really was listening and reading, if that ever was a question, as I sit here and kind of ponder over things I've learned. But learning that truth is local has really opened my eyes to why the church was so important to me, because being a part, again, I said earlier, like being from Oklahoma, there's some pretty black and white ideas in that part of the US and for that matter, all around the world in certain areas. What I thought to be a simple topic, various issues or that, you know, from sexuality to gender identity to racial issues and things like that, actually were not simple to issues. And people had lots of opinions on there, on their outcome and how we address them. And so learning that truth was local allowed me to understand that, oh, like actually being a part of Community of Christ opened me up to more truths and allowed me to actually realize that my upbringing and my heritage is a truth, but it's the importance there is to listen to other people's truths and to hear their background and their story, and then to weave together a collective truth as best we can with, you know, other people's stories informing that. So hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, it really does. And I think when I think of society at large and I think of the different places that we can find that kind of dialogue and that sense of community, the list is really short. Mm-hmm. Like, where else do you find that? And like you said, you know, particularly in Community of Christ, where we are a global church, you know, we're tiny little communities all around, which connects us really well to the broader church, because that's who our church family is, you know? So as I'm thinking of all of these things, I'm left with, where else do you find this? I mean, I don't know where else you find a community, that listens to each other and that is grounded in things like our enduring principles and our dedication to peace and, reconciliation and worth of all persons and all these things that make our lived experience so much better when we live them at our best. And then, you know, what does it look like when we're not living up to our best selves, and how do we hold each other accountable and with faithful disagreement and things like that? I mean, it's fascinating to me. And I have my undergrad in sociology. And so maybe that's partly why I tend to think that I'm maybe more religious than spiritual, because again, you know, the community aspect of that and hearing stories and just being in real life conversation and real life community with one another is just a really, really important aspect for me. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, we've been chatting for a while and I thank you for that. But I guess maybe we can leave our listeners with just what gives you hope as we move forward together as a church.
Oh, I have lots of things that give me hope in the church. And part of it is just simply dialogue and the continued willingness to come to the table and talk through really difficult topics. We have, I think, really established a culture of that, especially with common consent in Community of Christ. And it's no longer, and this is a sweeping generalization, but I see the church moving in this direction of it no longer being one way, one true church, one, you know, one right way to go, and more about getting feedback from more people and learning and hearing from their truths so that we can actually come together in a much more diverse and inclusive way. And I'm not just speaking simply to queer issues. I'm a very wide spectrum of topics, of course, but I really appreciate, and I think that dialogue is very much underrated because it's hard, it's time consuming, but you end up with such a better result when people are actually willing to do that. And I mean, I nerd out whenever I go to World Conference because I just love seeing the true breadth of like thoughts and theologies and ideologies. And it just seems to me like this is community. It doesn't just like, you know, move along without any bumps in the road. It's hard. It's community building is hard, and we have to be committed to it. But I love that we continue to be committed to it. You know, no one said this journey was going to be easy, but I so appreciate that we continue to do this. And I see that across a very broad age spectrum. I see lots of young adults and youth who are willing to come to the table and to share their stories and their truths. And I think that that's indicative of the fact that there still is a strong culture for that in Community of Christ, and it's being handed down, and that these young people feel like they have a voice is truly remarkable and I think really important. So I have lots of hope.
Parker, I just want to thank you so much for sharing all this. I think that your optimism, your story, and how it weaves together struggle and challenge, all while remaining just true to who you are and to seeing the potential in religion in general, and especially in Community of Christ, is just really inspiring. And I know that I've really benefited from our friendship and from your perspective. And I know that you are well loved in lots of different places in the church. And I just want to thank you for sharing a little bit of your time and of your story with us. And yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was great. I hope that my ramblings made sense to somebody out there. So this is good.
They did. I think they will be entertaining and helpful.
Good.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.